This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration? I didn't mean to do that. Please, continue.
Okay, it's easy for Samuel L. Jackson to capture your attention. It's not just the gun that gets you, it's his charisma. We just heard a clip from the Quentin Tarantino film, Pulp Fiction. Jackson has been in several other Tarantino films, including Jackie Brown and Django Unchained. He's made big-budget action films as well as low-budget independent films. He's been in several Spike Lee movies, including Jungle Fever, for which he was given a special award at the Cannes Film Festival. I spoke with Samuel L. Jackson in 2000.
I love the way you speak and the way you do your lines in film, so I thought I would play one of your great monologues. And this is a scene from Pulp Fiction, where you and John Travolta played hitmen, and toward the end of the movie, toward the very end, you have a religious awakening because you believe that only the intervention of God could explain why you weren't killed in the shootout. Mm-hmm. So at the very end, you're at a diner with John Travolta when two crazy people pull out their guns and demand that everyone hand over their money. So you get the gun away from the guy and quote the passage from the Bible to him that you used to quote before killing somebody. Mm-hmm. So let's play that scene. This is Samuel L. Jackson.
You read the Bible, Ringo?
Not regularly, no.
Well, there's this passage I got memorized. Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the iniquities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness. For he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know I am the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon you. I've been saying that shit for years. And if you heard it, that meant your ass. I never gave much thought to what it meant. I just thought it was some cold-blooded shit to say to a mother before I popped a cap in his ass. But I saw some shit this morning made me think twice. See, now I'm thinking, maybe it means you're the evil man and I'm the righteous man. And Mr. 9mm here, he's the shepherd protecting my righteous ass in the valley of darkness. Or it could mean you're the righteous man and I'm the shepherd. And it's the world that's evil and selfish. Now, I'd like that. But that ain't the truth. The truth is, you're the weak. And I'm the tyranny of evil men. But I'm trying, Ringo. I'm trying real hard to be the shepherd.
That is such a great scene. And you have such an interesting contrast there between the Bible reading and then all the slangy stuff that you're saying. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about your line readings there of the Bible and of the more colloquial lines as well? I don't know if you actually kind of, you know, decide in advance where you're going to breathe and which words you're going to emphasize or whether you just kind of do it in a more improvisational way.
Well, I do a lot of things. I break down scripts into beats, dramatic beats in the context of a scene. What one particular thing is trying to do, what the next thing is trying to do, and what explains what and why, which leads me to things that have to be together that don't have a breath and things that can be breathed between. It's not a science, but it's just good old-fashioned theater training where you learn to understand the purpose of each particular scene and what a sentence does in terms of moving that scene along or defining what came before it or what's going to come after it. And doing something textual like a Bible verse, you want to do it as straight as you possibly can. To make sure that the quotation marks are there. And after that, the explanation of what it may mean in this way or it may mean in that way until you get to the definitive moment of what it really means is, which is the most serious element of it, you know. But the truth is, you know, you're the weak and I'm the tyranny of evil men, which is like the, oh, my God, is he going to kill him? You have to have that suspense right there in that moment. And then, you know, he shows that he's kind of been redeemed by letting him go. But you just build tension by doing those things. It's kind of hard to explain, even in an, I guess, I was actually talking to somebody yesterday who told me they'd taken a film class last year, and all they studied was Pulp Fiction. And for the last 2 weeks, they tried to break down the diner scene. I don't know how you could dissect that movie in one particular way, because it's just impossible to do.
Well, one of the things you do so effectively is use pauses.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
Quentin's one of the few guys on screen that allows you to do stuff like that, because I was actually passing by Jackie Brown the other day. And
passing by a screening of Jackie Brown?
Between,
Passing by a screening of Jackie Brown?
No, I was passing by it on television. I was channel surfing. Channel surfing.
Okay.
And Jackie Brown was on television. And I was at the scene in the van with De Niro when we discovered the money has been gone, and I see there's a number of books in there, and I stopped to think about what happened. When we were doing that scene, I would look in the bag, think for a second, and then say, it's Jackie Brown. But Quentin would say, no, take your time. And I do it again. I count to like five, and he'd say, no. I mean, you know, go through the whole thing and think about, you know, how these books got here, what was going on in that place, and realize it's Jackie Brown. Take as much time as you want, which consequently led me to that almost, you know, 20-second pause in that film that he left in it. And I just think that's amazing that, you know, he trusts the fact that an audience is going to stay with you and start going through the process with you that long. Because a lot of times, people don't want dead air in a film like that, especially a thought process. They want to, you know, feed the audience the idea, feed the audience the answer really quick before they get, you know, before they lose their concentration. But Quentin trusts audiences like I do.
Now that you're a movie star, you have to use a gun a lot in your films. You were very briefly a security guard when you were a lot younger. I'm wondering two things. One, did you have a gun? And
no.
Two, were you in any real life action scenes, and were you able to use the kind of bravado that you can use in movies? Did you ever try that in real life?
Well, I didn't have a gun when I was a security guard. I just had a nightstick, which I really didn't want either, because I didn't want to pose a threat to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I was out there, as I told them, I was a reporter. If I saw something happening, I would call them on a walkie-talkie and tell them it was happening, or probably would wait until it was over and then tell them what had happened, because I didn't want to walk up on anybody doing anything. It was just a security job. I don't try and be the characters that I am on screen in real life, because I'm not that person. Yeah, I will defend my house and my family and my friends in specific kinds of ways, and I've been in confrontations with people because of that. But I don't walk around looking for trouble, or I will walk away from trouble before I'll stand up and let something escalate to that point the way it does in movies. Life's a little bit too volatile, and people are a little too crazy out here now.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I used to wonder why Bruce and Sylvester and guys like that had bodyguards. But they have bodyguards because people watch them in movies being tough guys, and sometimes a drunk or some guy somewhere out of his mind wants to find out if they really are John McClane or if they're Rocky, and they want to test themselves in that specific way. So you have somebody else to defuse that situation. Hopefully I won't have to be bothered with any of that.
Now, something happened to you in real life that a stuntman might have done if it was a movie. This happened in 1988. You were standing on, I guess you were entering a train in New York City. And
I was getting off, actually.
You're getting off, and your leg got caught in the closing door?
Yeah, the door closed on my ankle and the train took off, yes.
So you were dragged across the platform?
The length of the platform. Yeah, almost to, I was in the middle car of the last, I was in the middle door of the last car and was dragged to within a car length and a half of the tunnel, yeah.
What went through your mind as you were getting
dressed? It's going to be a very sad Christmas. It happened like December, somewhere around December 18th, and I couldn't find anything to hold on to. I was actually trying to figure out a way to get out of it. And there were people in the train trying to pull my shoe off. There were people pulling on the door, people pushing on my foot. I was trying to find some way to figure out how I could grab hold of something on the train and get as close to the train as I possibly could as the wall approached swiftly. And then, you know, it was kind of like, okay, this is it. I'm not going to make it. And I just kind of started thinking about how sad it was going to be, or, you know, who was going to call my house and tell them what had happened or whatever. And my life never flashed before my eyes. So I guess I should have known I wasn't going to die. As people always tell you, oh, your life flashes before your eyes. Well, none of that happened. So, but I was actually thinking of ways to survive.
So the train stopped in the nick of time.
Yeah, someone pulled the emergency cord.
And you won a lawsuit in 1996. You won about $500,000.
Yeah.
Were you hurt?
Yeah, I had to have my right knee surgically repaired. I mean, it tore all the ligaments in my right knee. Had a complete ACL tear, partial tear of the meniscus, all kinds of cartilage damage. So they had to do a lot of work to fix my knee. And I was on crutches for 10 months and went to rehab for like a year and a half.
Wow. Now, is there anything that you remember from that experience that you've been able to draw on in a movie? Like what real terror is, what real fear is that you are about to die?
Well, no, I don't give that much thought. Because I never felt terrorized, actually. It was a very calming kind of slow motion kind of thing. It's almost like people describing car accidents, where everything kind of goes very slowly until, you know, it's over, and then boom, everything comes back to real life. So I never had that element of terror. I've had, you know, some fearful moments in my life, you know, being in a car or being on a plane, I guess, maybe when a plane drops enormously while you're riding, hits an air pocket, or being disturbed in a storm like that. But I don't terrorize very easily.
When I hear more about your life, you were born in 1949 in Washington, D.C. Your parents divorced when you were how old?
I don't know. Maybe some months, maybe less than a year old.
Oh, okay. And then you went to live with your grandparents in Chattanooga, where your mother eventually joined you. What was it like moving from the North to the South, or were you too young to notice the difference?
I never even noticed. I was already there when I woke up and realized I was in the South. You know,
I was
an infant, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Were your parents, grandparents, or your mother strict with you?
Yeah, everybody was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a lot of restrictions. I had to be at home at a certain time. I had to make certain grades. I had to treat people with respect. I was expected to achieve certain things, and I was a lot more afraid of, you know, them than I was of the peer pressure. So I kind of did what they wanted me to do and not what everybody else wanted me to do.
When you say you were afraid of your grandparents and your mother, was that fear of their disapproval, or was there a more physical kind of punishment?
All of that. I didn't want to embarrass or disappoint them. And I actually grew up in the age of corporal punishment. You know? There's something about getting, you know, hit and whipped with switches or whatever that kind of makes, you know, pain a motivator, especially when you're small. The interesting thing about that is people always say, you know, corporal punishment is bad or it's not good or whatever. For every spanking I got, there was a hug that came along with it that explained to me, you know, how much they loved me and they were sorry they had to do that. But sometimes discipline comes in that form. I would much rather have been whipped and gotten it over with than go through some of those punishment phases, you know, where you can't go here, you can't use a phone for a month, you can't, you know, when you're restricted. It's a lot easier to just do it and get it over with.
No, I think I've made it clear that I love the way you speak. Did your family ever like try to correct your enunciation, or did you ever have a teacher who gave you a sense of diction, or is that something that you just had, or maybe you got it in the theater, maybe you were just that way?
My aunt was a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
She taught fourth grade, basically English and performing arts. So when I was very small, a lot of things were ingrained into me, especially, you know, grammatic things. Learning how to conjugate, come on, we all listen to television, we listen to people talk, and we kind of go, oh, my God. I know I do. Maybe we all don't, but I do sometimes. Or, you know, when people say, well, that's what he should have did. And you go, no, no, no. That's very simple. It's very simple. You know, so I was taught at a very early age how to speak, how to conjugate. And I guess learning to diagram sentences in that particular era was a great way of teaching people grammar. I don't even know if they still do it. I mean, my daughter couldn't do it when I was asking her about, you know, sentence structure. She's like, what are you talking about? So I don't know if it's even still taught. But, yeah, English was a very huge part of my school training.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When you were growing up in Tennessee, did you see mm-hmm. movies in segregated theaters?
Yeah. We had two theaters, the Liberty and the Grand, that were maybe a block from each other where we went to the movies. We weren't allowed to go downtown to the theater, so I didn't even bother. I just always was going to my theaters. It was fine.
Were there movies you couldn't see because they didn't come to the black theaters?
No. There were movies that were edited in specific ways for the whole South. I mean, they didn't just not show them in the black community. They didn't show them that way in the white communities either. What is that? Drums of the South with Sidney Poitier and Rhonda Fleming when he was this slave who goes to the North and comes back as a Union officer. That was a point in that movie where he slaps her because she's like passing for white. And that was a point in the movie where he slaps her. They didn't show that at the white theater, and they definitely didn't show it at the black theater because they just weren't going to show black people hitting white people in the movies.
When I spoke with him in 2000, Jackson talked about his obsessive personality, which didn't help when he began to develop a heavy cocaine habit in the 1980s, a habit he was able to kick after going to rehab.
It's easy for me to understand who I am or to know what the message was people were trying to get to me when I got to rehab about me and understanding my personality. I mean, all the men in my family basically have died from alcoholism or some form of it. And that means that, yeah, it is a family disease, and I could possibly have that, and I probably did, because like all of them, if I bought a six-pack of beer, I drank six beers. I didn't drink one and put the other five up. I drank all six of them. I never, you know, saved anything for the next day. That's my personality.
Do you think that obsessive quality, you know, of like you have one, then you have six, also mm-hmm. has a positive side through your acting? I mean, are you obsessive about learning parts and, you know, learning them and doing the line readings just the way you want to do them?
Yeah, I'm as aggressive about my job and golf as I was about, you know, getting high and having the kind of fun that I used to have. I'm having a lot more fun now because I can remember what fun I had. And I can talk to people about it. And nobody's calling me to say, do you really feel that way about me? What are you talking about? So it's better. When I used to wonder how I would live without that, it was mind-boggling to me. Will I be as much fun? Will I be able to laugh? Will I even be able to act? All those questions got answered. And I'm enjoying my life a lot more. And the interesting thing for me is, I was a fine actor, I was a good actor, and I could do things when I was using. But when I stopped using, I became a much better actor and a lot more successful actor. I don't think that if I went back to using, I would be as successful or everything I have now would find a way to go away. Because that's not what God intended for me or what my public wants from me in terms of what I give them when they come to see me work.
My guest is Samuel Jackson. Let's listen to a clip from the 1991 film Jungle Fever, in which Jackson played a crack addict named Gator. He's pleading for money from his family, money they don't want to give him because they know how he'll use it. Here he is trying to wear them down.
Oh, look at here. I'm a little light, though.
What, you didn't get your check from Soul Train yet?
Yo, Don lost my address. Come on, hit me.
some cash in my hand.
Now, you got a special award at the Cannes Film Festival for your performance in Jungle Fever, in which you played a crack addict. Having been a cocaine user, were there things that you felt you really understood firsthand about, you know, someone who uses drugs that you could use in that role?
Oh, definitely. I understood that it was easy to play the effects of being high and just do that on the surface of what's going on with Gator. But I also knew that the family dynamic and how people ruin their relationships with people in their drug use was the important element of doing that particular role of alienating everybody around him to the point where when he dies, everybody kind of understands it and knows what his father was going through and how he just collapsed every bridge that he had to humanity by doing that, because we all did it.
Were you close to doing that, to just burning a lot of bridges?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I had used up, you know, everybody's friendship when I said, you know, oh, man, I broke so-and-so, I need some money to do this. People knew that, okay, he's going to buy some drugs with that. Or I had alienated everybody in my house, you know, was scared to talk to me. The few friends that I knew or the few friends I used with, we were all kind of looking at each other strange, too, because we were using each other up. It was really important to me to show that this guy was personable. He used his connections to people to use them, to abuse those friendships. So that in the end, he was alone. So by the time he died, his death meant something to the people around him. It was not so much a tragedy as a relief. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people that I met or ran into after seeing that film, you know, described Gator as their brother, their husband, their sons, somebody close to them, any family member, because they'd all been abused that way.
You're kind of a sex symbol now.
No kidding.
And I'm wondering if, like, you see your own body in a different way, you know, now that so many people, like, would desire you. Do you know what I mean? Now that there's so many people who are, you know, imagining you. I don't have to keep going, do I?
yeah. Tell me.
So do you see yourself differently?
No, I see myself as the same guy I always was.
Did you ever sit home alone and bored for a few minutes thinking, well, I may be bored now, but I know a lot of people are probably really thinking about me?
No. But, you know, to be honest, I actually do some days walk the street and I wonder how many people are going to recognize me today.
And?
I walk through crowds of people sometimes to see who will notice that I walk through that crowd. I do that. I mean, I'm not, you know, crazy enough to think that people aren't going to notice me, or I'm not so confident or bored by the attention or bothered by the attention sometimes that I try to avoid it. Sometimes I'm like, you know, just walking around just trying to see what will happen if somebody sees me.
My interview with Samuel Jackson was recorded in 2000, and that concludes our archive series, Classic Films and Movie Icons. Tomorrow, we're back to new interviews. If Kamala Harris wins the election, she'll be our second biracial president. What it means to be biracial, the meaning of race itself and how that keeps changing, is the theme of the novels and the memoir by tomorrow's guest, Danzy Senna. Her mother is white and comes from an eminent Boston family. Her father is black and grew up in an orphanage in Alabama. Danzy Senna was born in 1968, a year after the Supreme Court overturned all the state laws that outlawed interracial marriage. Her new novel is called Colored Television. I hope you'll join us. To keep up with what's on the show and get highlights of our interviews, follow us on Instagram at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Monique Nazareth, Thea Chaloner, Susan Yukundi, and Joel Wolfram. Special thanks to NPR Plus producer Nick Anderson. Our digital media producers are Molly C.V. Nesper and Sabrina Sewer. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.